This is a CBC original podcast.
So I knocked on the door, and Rebecca welcomed me in this palatial penthouse suite. It was two stories tall, and it looked over the Atlantic Ocean. And inside, there was this grand piano. There was a number of sitting areas, and there was Ali. And Ali looked at me through the corner of his eye. He had his back turned to me, and he was doing magic tricks. And the first trick he was doing was levitation. And I'm looking at this, and no one's introduced me yet. I haven't even gone up and said hello. And he actually did look like he was coming off the ground. I thought, wow, that's pretty good. And he turned around, he started doing sleight of hand with handkerchiefs, making things disappear up his sleeve, pulling things out of his sleeves. And again, hasn't said a word, just looking at me. And I'm thinking to myself, this is really strange. What's going on here? But let me start at the beginning.
From Louisville, Kentucky, return of the champion, Muhammad Ali.
It came from nowhere. Ali came through with a left.
I'm Mark Lee, and this is Backstory.
It's over. Ali is the knockout winner at 2 minutes.
An exclusive interview with Muhammad Ali, 1987.
I told you I'm the real champion. I told you I'm the champion of the world.
Muhammad Ali's importance was well beyond boxing, well beyond sport. He was probably the most recognizable figure in the world. I mean, he fought 23 title fights in 10 years, which is incredible. But it was more his personality.
You got any secret plans for that?
He will be mine in round nine, and I ain't lying.
Ali had a gift for the language. He wasn't well educated, but he could spar with anyone verbally.
And if he keeps talking jive, I'll get him in five. If he makes me sore, I'll get him in four, like Archie Moore on the floor.
He had a poetic way of setting up his fights. The way he captivated the media with his gift for gab, his turn of phrase, his confidence.
If that don't do, we'll get him in two.
He was on all the time, and the media couldn't get enough of him.
And if he runs, we can get him in one.
I like that.
So Muhammad Ali first burst onto the scene in 1960 in Rome at the Olympics, where he won the gold medal in the light heavyweight category. He was just 18 years old.
Cassius Clay of the United States has proven to be the class of these 1960 Rome Olympics.
The thing about Ali is that all the writers doubted him. They thought he wasn't as good as he talked, but he could walk the talk.
The decision goes to Cassius Clay of the United States. The
Eckerkowski. I'm in Memphis, and I just turned 22 years old. I must be the greatest. I told the world.
And so Ali would go on to win the heavyweight title three times. No one had ever seen a heavyweight with that skill, that ability to dance, a man brave enough to fight with his guard down.
Cassius Clay carrying his left hand dangerously low.
In his prime, he never put his dukes up. He always had them down at his side. He always did the shuffle. He always, floated like a butterfly and stung like a bee. He used to joke that he was so fast that when he turned the light off,
hit the switch, was in the bed before the room was dark.
Incredible.
Fast.
And so people ultimately had to agree that he was the greatest. Ali fought an amazing 23 title fights in 10 years. That takes a lot out of a person. It began to show in the mid-70s. He was beginning to take shots that he didn't take before. Those head shots were landing. And it was at that time that Ferdy Pacheco, his doctor, said to Ali,
"You know, that's it. You should not fight anymore. You can't even beat this guy Norton convincingly. You might as well hang it up."
And Ali said, "You know what? I think I lost this fight."
And he was tired, and he thought he'd lost also. And he said, "Yeah, I think that's it. I think I can't go anymore. I'm just tired. I can't do it anymore."
But then Ali's handlers got to him, and there was lots of money to be made still. I mean, he's still the champion. And he hung on, and he hung on.
And then all of a sudden, they line up more fights, and I say, I don't think this guy should fight again.
Freddy Pacheco had told him to quit, that there was now clinical evidence that his body was shutting down. There was blood in his urine after fights. He was not the same person. There was a lethargy about him after fights. He didn't recover the same way.
I said to him and his handlers and people around him, I really think that there's now laboratory evidence that things are falling apart, and that's the end of the road. And if you don't make him stop right now, then I at least am not going to be a party to this.
And that was enough for Freddy Pacheco. He said, I can't be your doctor if you're not going to listen to me. And he left Ali. He quit. And so there was this decline of Ali, and you could hear it in his voice.
I fight so regular. I've prepared for so many fights that I can't afford to dodge each punch or to try to beat him each day.
His ability to be poetic and have these great rhythmic statements, you could start to hear the decline, and you could hear the exhaustion in his voice when he talked about what it took to stay a heavyweight champion.
I got to do it today, and the next day, and the next day. Then after that, the hard fight, a week or two rest, then I start another fight. And this goes on. This has been 24 years.
By the end, he was in hospital. And this is when doctors diagnosed him at that point as suffering from Parkinson's syndrome. And doctors said he had taken too many hits to the head. We wanted to do the Ali story in 1987 because that's when there was now clinical evidence of head trauma, concussion, long-term brain damage that was beginning to come out in studies of boxing. And Ali made the perfect example. If this great champion, the greatest as he called himself, could suffer the effects of boxing, then what about everybody else? The question was, could we get Ali? That would be the hardest part because he didn't want to be seen or heard in the condition he was now in.
You notice he's not going around making speeches anymore because he don't want to. It's an embarrassment to him. Everybody seeing the comparison of this young, energetic guy, then all of a sudden he's unable to give himself to the public, which he's always been able to do. And that bothers him.
And so we worked for at least a month trying to get this interview with Ali. And his people kept stonewalling us and saying, well, get back to us next week, get back to us the following week. And on it went. So we'd waited a month to try to get an interview with Ali, and then we were told that he would be at a chocolate convention in Miami Beach, Florida, on this weekend before we were going to go to air. And so they told us, go there, you might get an interview, you might not, take your chances. So there I was sitting on an Air Canada jet, getting ready to fly to Miami Beach. And the flight was delayed because of a lightning storm. And during that delay, I ended up striking up a conversation to the woman next to me. She said her name was Rebecca. She said, so what are you going to Miami for? I said, well, I work for CBC and we're doing a documentary on Muhammad Ali. We've been trying for a month. And I've heard that he's going to be at this chocolate convention in Miami Beach. So I'm going down there. Right now, it's just a hope and a prayer. And she says, that's amazing. I'm actually going to Miami Beach to see Muhammad Ali as well. I'm his agent for this new chocolate chip cookie that he's promoting called The Champ. And I said, you're kidding. Might you be able to help me get an interview? We've been trying for over a month. And she said, of course.
The ballroom of the lavish Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach resembles a scene from the movie Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
So Ali arrives about 9 o'clock in the morning at the convention.
Thousands of people line up to get Ali's autograph.
And there's no emotion.
He looks sedated. His eyes are glassy. There's no more twinkle. And his speech comes slowly and painfully.
And they sit him down at this round table. In the middle of the table is this big plate of cookies, chocolate chip cookies, and bags around it that say the champ. And it was kind of sad, really. I mean, here was this three-time heavyweight champion, the most famous person probably on the planet, promoting chocolate chip cookies. People lined up by the thousands all day long. People brought their babies, and he kissed them. They just wanted to touch him.
Can I touch your hand?
Can she shake?
Thank you. You're wonderful.
He signed autographs, and that's where a lot of people were a little bit in shock, because
his left hand trembles while his right hand scrawls what is perhaps the most recognizable name in the world.
He could barely sign his name, and on the cookie bag, his signature was right there. And so you could see the way he used to sign his name, and you could see the squiggly way he signed it now because he'd lost his motor control because of Parkinson's. I had been at this chocolate convention all day. His appearance was wrapping up. And Ali and his entourage got up to leave, and I waited at the exit. And Rebecca, his agent, went by, and I said, "So what do you think? Is there any chance for an interview?" And she said, "Just wait here. I'll do my best. And if you hear from me, I'll call the phone here in the convention center ballroom. There's a phone there. Wait there." Like, there were no cell phones, right? I was about to lose my only contact with Ali and his agent and may never see them again as they left. All I had was wait by this house phone. So I waited, and a half hour later, the phone rang, and it was Rebecca. She goes, "Mark, come right up."
Ali was reluctant at first, but eventually he granted me a rare recorded interview inside his hotel suite, away from the crowds. Before we talked, he entertained me with sleight-of-hand magic tricks, and he played the piano, almost as if he was determined to show he wasn't an invalid.
In the piece we did, you can hear him playing, and it's not a very difficult piece, but he's doing it as fast as he can, and then within about 20 to 30 seconds, he starts to lose his motor control. And all of a sudden, he's all over the keys and it falls apart.
Whoa, that's great.
So we start the interview.
I feel good sometimes, a little tired, but I know that I feel good.
How does it affect you, Jen?
I feel tiredness. Slurred speech. Sometimes I shake or tremor in my hand.
And within about 10 minutes of the interview, into the area about which we were doing our documentary, which was head blows. And I think the question was, do you think that you stayed too long, well past your prime, and took too many punches to the head, and that's why you're in the situation you are today? And he said, "Turn off the tape recorder." I went, "Okay, this is bad." And he said, "How do you think I'm sounding right now?" He wasn't sounding very good. It was slurring. He was drooling. But I said, "You know what? You're sounding just fine, champ. Just fine." And then, in a flash, he threw this punch right at my head.
Ali with a left.
A fuselage of punches by Muhammad Ali.
And now Ali is behaving like the old Ali.
He came right within an inch of my cheek. And I went flying to my left, away from the punch, falling onto the floor, dropped the microphone. He thought I was feeling sorry for him by saying, "You know, you sound great. You know, there's no," when he knew he didn't sound great. He knew that. He was an honest person. But when I flew and respected his punch, he was happy. He thought, you know what, this guy still respects me. He still thinks that, you know, that I could knock his head off. And we've all seen people fake punches and stuff like that, or if you're playing with your friends or whatever. This was the heavyweight champion three times over with a fist right at my cheekbone, and it was lightning fast. And I looked at him, and he had a big smile on his face, big grin. And he said, let's go. We continued the interview.
My thing was to be just what I am now, the most recognized human on earth. Worldwide, this face you're looking at now, more people know me than Pope and Reagan together.
I mean, the contrast in seeing him in the flesh and seeing what had become of him was, quite frankly, shocking. But I could still hear Ali through his slurred speech. I could still hear the old Ali.
Thank you very much for the interview. I feel very privileged.
Well, where's my check?
And it was just the old Ali that came out again. And so that was reassuring. But I felt sad for a man who used to be known for his quick wit and his boxing, both of which had now deserted him.
I'm experienced now, professional. Jaw's been broke, been lost, knocked down a couple of times, been chopping trees. I done something new for this fight. I done wrestled with an alligator. I done tussled with a whale. I done handcuffed lightning, throw thunder in jail. That's bad. Only last week, I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick.
Bad dude.
Bad.
Fast.
Just as I said those many years ago.
He's still a very proud person who wants no sympathy. So don't feel sorry for Muhammad Ali.
Backstory is recorded and produced by Cecil Fernandez. For more behind-the-scenes stories, visit cbc.ca/backstory or subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. I'm Mark Lee.
For more CBC original podcasts, go to cbc.ca/originalpodcasts.